So in my late 20s, I was working as a journalist in New York City. I'd written, you know, a bunch for places like the New York Times Magazine and so on. But I had a massive kind of spiritual crisis, existential crisis. I'd grown up in a scientific, materialist kind of construct, which is basically a form of nihilism, atheism. You know, as far as I knew or assumed, you know, this life was the only thing that we could experience, and after it there was like permanent darkness. And, you know, I began to recognize that all of this kind of frantic activity in New York was kind of obfuscating, obscuring, you know, distracting people, you know, from this confrontation with, you know, the void and this kind of nothingness that our society kind of offered them. So when I you know, really began to take that in and go through this crisis, I began to question for myself, you know, okay, when I'd grown up, you know, in the scientific culture, but how did I really know that that was the case? You know, were there any other access points to other forms of consciousness, other dimensions of being or knowing? You know, what tools might exist to check out, you know, if there was more going on in the cosmos than I'd grown up with expecting? And when I went through that thought process, I remembered my psychedelic experiences back in college, where I'd been in Connecticut. I'd taken, you know, mushrooms and LSD a handful of times, and I definitely found them to be some of the most profound and amazing experiences that I'd ever had on many levels. I mean, I remember like the sense with mushrooms of what I would call like a social deconditioning effect. You know, that you recognize that the world that we built around us was in some ways kind of an artificial construct and a transitory one. You know, that people were, as Mario was talking about earlier today, kind of totally enmeshed in the past, you know, worries about the past, you know, or whatever, or worries about the future. Or just beaming into things that had nothing to do with the present moment, like sports spectacles or stock tickets or whatever. So I just remember that mushroom experience being this profound shock, where I recognized that a lot of stuff that, you know, when you're socially conditioned into our society, you just begin to accept as natural, were actually just conventions or inventions. And that, you know, the next thought that one has is that you know, really we could you know, convene a different reality. You know, if these conventions were the product of a history of a kind of all these forces and these systems that have kind of reached a certain kind of inertia, you know, it might be possible to step into a different type of arrangement. You know, so when I had my existential emergency, I remembered these psychedelic experiences, and I was a journalist, so I decided that I would then explore these subjects, you know, fully, deeply. So, you know, breaking open the head, my first book, I had this experience. I then worked with a tribe in the Amazon, Ecuador, with ayahuasca. How many people here have heard of ayahuasca? Just like the rest of you. Probably like the same group. And then I visited the Mazatec Indians in Oaxaca, Mexico, which is where the magic mushrooms were rediscovered in the 1950s by the West, by Gordon Wasson and a very fascinating character, investment banker and his wife. Then I also looked into dimethyltryptamine, DMT. DMT, show of hands. How many people here have smoked DMT, just out of curiosity? Smaller group. DMT is a substance that's in our brain, it's in our spinal column, it's made by many different plants, and if you're just trying to eat the stuff, nothing happens, because there are enzymes in your gut that recognize it and neutralize it. However, if you smoke it, you smoke enough of the stuff, and it's a very strange substance. It's kind of like very, very like sort of plasticky in a way. If you smoke it, it sends you on the most kind of mysteriously powerful experience you probably have as a human being. You kind of shoot out of your body, you lose all contact with this dimension, and you enter into another dimension which seems, if anything, more real than this one. A dimension of geometries, patterns, incredible colors. In my book, I think I described it as Walt Disney World meets Tibetan mandalas in the 25th century. Another writer about a lot of these subjects, Terence McKenna, talked about it as meeting these beings that a lot of people have these experiences of meeting beings, which he referred to as the machine elves of hyperspace. So I explored the DMT, obviously LSD, and then I also was really thinking about the whole history of the Western world, the modern West, and it really began to seem that, you know, here you have these natural substances, plant-based substances that were still sacred core, sacred center of a lot of these indigenous and tribal cultures. Yet in our culture, they were demonized, made illegal, and ridiculed and repressed. So it just seems strange to me. And if you go back to the whole history of the West, go back to the Middle Ages and the witch hunts. There we find that the ruling classes of that time made a war against people who were witches or wise women who possessed second sight and who were also beholders of the use of visionary plants at that time. So we kind of, in a way, I would say the modern, what I talk about in my books, is that the modern West became kind of possessed by a certain form of consciousness, a certain relationship to reality. And that was a very materialist based empirical way of relating to the world, and we, in that process, we negated and almost aggressively tried to kind of exterminate this other form of consciousness, this other form of awareness that that shamans possess, so that shamanic cultures have naturally. And so when we went around the world, we came to this continent, we destroyed the books of the Maya. We, either tried to assimilate the shamans or, murdered them, basically. And so it was really like a war against a certain form of consciousness. And, we're all inheritors of that history, and I think trying to heal that division, and bring... bring back that intuitive approach, visionary approach to the world. Maybe that's part of what 2012 actually could signify. So as I was doing this research, I began to learn. I understood that shamanic cultures could have valid knowledge of past and future events. And that these other type of occult and psychic experiences also had validity, and that because I had a number of them. I didn't really believe in the occult until, I started to have like poltergeist phenomena and stuff like that. I think that I try to be a fairly sane and grounded person. I don't know if I achieve that, but I tend to really need a lot of evidence to convince me of anything. So over time, I accepted that these other cultures have a valid knowledge system, but they were actually just interested in different aspects of reality, different aspects of being and experiencing than the modern world has been focusing on. And I think you feel that very profoundly when you go to the Mayan sites, whatever the problems with that culture, including human sacrifice, they had some profound attunement to kind of deeper levels of reality that's expressed in their architecture and their visionary art. So basically, once I accepted that these cultures had validity, I began to learn that a lot of indigenous and traditional cultures around the world have an understanding of this time as this time of transformation. Obviously, as you heard today from Jenkins, it seems as if we can tease out most specifically from the classical Mayan culture that that there's an end of a cycle of time and the beginning of another cycle. I would say that we don't really know exactly what's going to happen. We don't know whether something is going to happen exactly on that date, or if we're just in a longer period of transformation. I think we'd like to see something dramatically positive happen, and I don't think it's out of the question. There's also legitimate concerns that we're going to see a lot of very negative things happen. I really feel this profound uncertainty, I have to say. That's where I'm at right now. I've had a number of personal psychic indicators that point towards this whole thing having tremendous validity. But then, when I look around the world, I find myself extremely dubious. And then there's the whole question, which I think different speakers here have been talking about in different ways, is how is our consciousness influencing this project? I really love a lot of José Arguelles' ideas. Obviously he's going to speak tomorrow. He was one of the big influences in my thought. For instance, the idea that the universe is somehow a art project. So for me, how do we become co-creative artists with this larger art project? In my book 2012, one large section of it is around the crop circle phenomenon in England. How many people here have taken a deep look at the crop circles or gone over there to see them? That was another area where I started as a skeptic, needed evidence. But I began really from my psychedelic experiences. In psychedelics, you often go into these intensely geometric patterned other realities that don't really seem like they could just be constructed by your own mind. It feels like it has to be interaction with some higher intelligence or something. So then I was like, well, if these things happen internally, is there any external evidence for that, or any correlative kind of data out in the world? And I remembered the crop circles, which I assumed were a hoax. But I began to look at them, and I found they were developed to extremely amazing patterns, amazing phenomena. And I managed to get an assignment from Wired magazine to write about them, which gave me an excuse to talk to scientists who've been studying the phenomena, and researchers, even some of the people who claim to be the hoaxers of the phenomena. And the more I learned, the more fascinating it became. And then I'd already been thinking about the whole 2012 subject, one of the people I spoke to, Michael Glickman, who's been researching them for decades, said that he believed that from his research, the crop circles were pointing to something that he called the dimensional shift, and that shift had happened, started around 1999, 2000, and was deepening, and would complete its process in 2012. He felt that many of the crop circles were kind of indicating that, and even use calendrical kind of puzzles. So there'd be a crop circle that would pop up, there'd just be a grid of these squares, and if you counted the number of squares, it would be the number of weeks from the appearance of that crop circle to the end of 2012. So I ended up spending a whole summer in England and then going back there and talking to lots of people. And I ended up thinking that the whole phenomenon could not be entirely a human-made hoax, maybe not even largely a human-made hoax, and that therefore it was some type of communication, between another form of intelligence and us. And the best way that I can think, figure out how to talk about it or think about it is that it's somehow the crop circle phenomenon represents a kind of education, that some other consciousness in the universe, or some galactic, maybe level intelligence, is trying to teach us something about the nature of consciousness and the nature of our reality. And it's doing it, in this very gentle and creative and clever and actually quite fun way. In terms of evidence, there's biologists, biophysicists who study what happens to the plants, the formations, and have had papers published in peer-reviewed journals that show molecular changes to the plants that wouldn't appear if they'd just been knocked down by boards and string. There's also the subjective experience of going into the patterns, especially the new ones. You feel a palpable energetic charge, and I've seen, people with dowsing pendulums, which totally pull off access because there's an energetic shift in the formations. then there's the synchronicities that happen when you get into the whole thing. The first one I went into was I'd written Breaking Up in the Head. It hadn't come out yet. I was the first one that I went into with a group was, it turned out to be a double mushroom formation that had encoded in it all this material that I discussed in my book, which hadn't been published yet. And the material was around how apparently there was a mushroom cult in early Christianity, and that they used the Tree of Life could also be kind of read as a Amanita muscaria mushroom, depending on whether you were an initiate into the esoteric side of that sect or not. And sort of underlying this was something that could just be read as the roots of that tree or as a psilocybin mushroom. And if you read the psychedelic literature, there's a lot of discussion over the idea that maybe human communion with the mushroom, the psilocybin, led to the origin of religion, perhaps even the origin of language and culture. And there's kind of a discussion among psychedelic scholars whether it was the Amanita species or the psilocybin species. So all of this incredibly complex information was happened to be encoded in this first crop circle that I went into. So I had a number of experiences like that. But then I also had the experience of bringing people to the phenomenon and witnessing their response. And it actually really began to seem that it was kind of, well, I'll give you an example. I brought a couple from California who were skeptical about crop circles. They stayed with me for 4 days, they rented a car, and they were kind of snickering about it. And every pattern that we went into absolutely sucked. They were kind of, they looked like they just been knocked down, brusquely. You'd almost find like the boards right outside of them. I was embarrassed to be interested in the whole thing. And I was, they left, and then, other friends of mine came who were more open to it. And then we began to have extraordinary experiences, like one after another, going into these things that were totally pristine, having kind of visionary, intuitive breakthroughs and stuff. And then I began to collect, data about other people. There was a woman who was much more like a New Age bliss bunny type. She went into a crop circle, and she said that these balls of light appeared to her, and they loved her so much, they followed her back to New York City, and they now live in her bathroom. she calls them the extra celestials. And then we met this other guy who was like a kind of paranoid, military UFO conspiracy guy, and I was in a pattern with him. And for the first time that I'd ever seen one, like a huge black helicopter appeared overhead and kept circling the formation for the whole time that we were there. And I almost felt like it was his like energetic frequency or energetic field that brought in that. So it began to seem to me that the crop circles, taken as a whole, as a teaching on the nature of consciousness, that they were kind of pointing towards what you allow yourself to imagine, or what you're prepared to, open up to, in some way, with some form of belief, is what the universe will reflect back at you. And that's also very much a psychedelic insight. People who explore psychedelics, you constantly see your psyche kind of, deeply amplified and magnified by the physical events and experiences that happen to you. What is the story with extraterrestrials, ETs, and all that? It seems likely to me that we're on the cusp of learning that what we think of as our local history, our natural history, and our human history, are maybe aspects of a much larger galactic continuum. That seems to be indicated to a certain extent by the crop circles, a lot of different types of evidence and theories. The last couple of years, there's been how many people here have seen a convincing UFO in their lives? Yes. How many people here have been abducted? Just two. Three. Extra credit after class. It seems like the last few years there's been a massive increase in UFO sightings. Very strange statements by the Vatican. The chief astronomer of the Vatican a couple of years ago said that if you're Catholic, it's now okay to believe in extraterrestrial life, and that if there are extraterrestrials, they will not have to be converted to Catholicism because they're not. information they have at their disposal. And I've also heard that the Vatican controls a lot of the astronomical observatories on the planet, plus have a huge trove of libraries of esoteric knowledge that they probably aren't sharing with anybody. And once again, I mean, the whole relationship with this other seems to be one that is co-creative. And it seems, when I wrote about it in 2012, you look at all the stuff about the gray aliens and these abduction narratives that are so negative, it's hard not to see that as somehow a projection of our contemporary psychology and our contemporary mindset, and that the first beings that seem to be stepping towards us are ones who, you know, are totally into the material, technological realm, are kind of like, as the story goes, if you look at a lot of these abduction accounts, are interested in, you know, collecting our genes, you know, making hybrids, you know, so they've kind of seen us as like the same way we treat like herd animals, they seem to be interacting with us. Maybe we're getting the types of aliens we deserve. So I mean, you know, maybe you know, if we change our framework of consciousness, we might actually get different types of experience, different much more positive kind of encounters. I mean, that would be my great hope for 2013. Would be like to be hanging out with you know, awesome extraterrestrials who, you know, are fun to pal around with, you know. I mean, one thing that the crop circles to me indicate, you know, we have this, you know, because we're locked in a science technology mindset, you know, we tend to think that, you know, oh, if there's an extraterrestrial, it's going to be all about this, like, super technology, you know, warp drive, you know, big laser beams or whatever. Whereas, you know, if you look at the crop circle thing, take it somewhat seriously, you know, it's basically an amazing art project. And, you know, maybe, you know, if you think about advanced intelligence or you know, evolution of consciousness, you know, it wouldn't be just compiling more technological stuff. It actually would be, you know, like any extraterrestrial species we encounter would be like some form of genius, you know, conceptual arts, you know. And first we'd have to kind of understand the nature of their art project to be able to get along with it. Whole realm and, you know, disclosure project, all that stuff. And it's definitely a whole area of thinking that I find fascinating. I also wonder to what extent it's a distraction or a deviation or, you know, kind of masturbatory waste of time. You know, when we're facing a planetary situation that does seem to be, you know, extremely dire. And so then the question is, you know, how do we address that? I mean, that seems to be the biggest question that I get asked, and I kind of heard, you know, reverberated even around this event. Is you know, for those of us who you know are seeing this capacity or potential for this evolution that the Venus Project guy was talking about, although I don't really know the technology, but like 1950s futuristic, maybe that's right. You know, how do we get there? How would we engineer a workable global civilization? You know, it seems like there's a blockade or blockage on human consciousness for the most part right now. And you know, once again, one of the thoughts that I have, or uncertainties I have, is whether there is a conscious kind of enemy. You know, whether there's some either alien and/or occult force that is somehow, you know, pressing us down and trying to keep us in a realm of limitation and lower vibration. You know, or if it's just that, you know, that we're in this natural evolutionary process. You know, I can't help but be fascinated by the David Icke and Michael Sarian material about the reptilians. How many people here have delved down that deep, grotesque rabbit hole? You know, so it's like you know, on the one level, it seems totally absurd. But then I talk to people. I have a friend who has hung out with like these like super tycoon billionaires, and said they do kind of radiate this unusual energy. Another friend of mine, his father is very powerful in government, and he talked, you know, he's not a spiritual guy at all. This diplomat, But he talked about how when he was in the presence of some people like the Queen of England, he felt almost unable to think or something. It was almost like a blockage. It's in some secondhand, reports like that. And then we look at the whole phenomenon of Obama, the amount of energy that was galvanized around Obama, and then, how little that he's actually accomplished, and how, despite, mimicking compassion, he's actually fully supported the military-industrial complex and the predatory financial system. I mean, he's actually continued all of Bush's policies, and he's continued to, create imaginary money and pour it on the financial elite through the banking industry. So Goldman Sachs has like never had a better year. And then we think about Obama and we look at who he is, genetically. The David Icke and Michael Sarian idea is that there was some type of reptilian interpolation through genetic material into certain bloodlines that include the royal families of Europe and so on, and the Bush family and so on. And then it turns out that Obama is actually distantly related to Cheney and to Bush. As I said, I reside in profound uncertainty, which is really frustrating. Because I don't think you can act very effectively until you believe something, I wrestle a lot with this idea of belief. How many people here wrestle with the idea of belief? Good. Yeah, because, belief is really complicated. Because, once you believe in something, you've kind of given yourself over to that thing. And then you can't, you create a tunnel for yourself, a reality tunnel, and then you start going down that tunnel, and these other options kind of fall away. One idea I've had as a possible dodge out of that is what if you believe that you also create your own beliefs, So then you can go down the reality tunnel of some crazy belief as long as you remember that you also believe that you create your own beliefs. Would that work? What's that? You look for the synchronicities. Yeah, but sometimes the synchronicities are flaky or taking in the wrong direction.
Biology of Belief.
The Biology of Belief. That's a very interesting book. It's a worthy, interesting construct there. So I went back. I instinctively start to deviate down these crazy rabbit holes of reptilians and extraterrestrials. But to get back to the main line. The question is, how could we, in such a short period of time, and we don't really know, as I said, we don't know what 2012 signifies, we don't know how long we have, we do know that we're facing an intensifying biospheric crisis. We know that, according to scientific projections, 25% of all mammalian species, maybe all species in general, will be extinct in 30 years. We know that, according to scientific projections, all of the tropical rainforests on Earth we've gone in 40 years. We know that the oceans are now 90% fished out of large fish. In a way, an amazing achievement on our part, because 30 years ago, the ocean seemed so vast. Nobody even thought. That's the thing. It's so recent even to have this understanding that we live on such a limited and fragile way. So clearly, the resource-intensive, extractive, life model that we've created as a global society, is probably not going to be able to continue as is for much longer. Do we all agree with that?
Yeah.
And sometimes the illusion feels so strong, and it's all still going on, that I lose my own perspective on that. I think if we look at it factually as best we can, and then we have climate change accelerating, that's also very peculiar because sometimes we expect it to get really warm and then it's like freezing in England, so it's more like the fluctuations are becoming more intense, and it's becoming more unpredictable, climate, which is affecting agricultural tables, which may change the amount of food that's available, which may lead to mass starvation, which could lead to huge food riots and mass migrations. It seems like all this stuff is coming down the pike. And yet, you know, so then a lot of people, you know, get into this mind frame that, you know, there's going to be a huge death, you know, that two-thirds of the Earth's population is going to die in the next few years. How many people here kind of gravitate to that view, that there's going to be a huge loss of life in the next, like, 10, 15 years? Yeah, I mean, I personally don't know if that has to be the case. And you know, because actually, like, I mean, as I just drove around Guatemala and San Cristobal, I mean, there's lots of, you know, empty land in upstate New York. You know, anywhere we go, there's lots of, you know, stuff around. You know, so it seems to be more of a question of how we organize our productive capacities, and if we can actually make a deep change in the kind of fundamental. You know, I think we need to change both the kind of paradigm of our society and then the infrastructure, you know, of our social systems, which are now all designed around, you know, as we heard other speakers talk about, ego and greed and, you know, what can I get for myself to protect, you know, those people around me. So I think the first thing, the first way we'd have to think about how this transformation could happen is we'd have to look at, you know, consciousness itself. So we need to figure out models that can help us to make this transition really quickly. And for me, one of those main things that would be necessary would be to bring communities back together again. There's a model from England called Transition Town. Have people heard about that at all? So Transition Town is the idea that you educate your local community around peak oil, climate change, sustainability issues, you know, the economic, you know, system. It's, you know, it's incredible injustices, and you know, get more people involved. You have screenings, you have talks, and then ultimately you create enough of a factions that you can pressure local governments and local businesses to make changes. You know, so that you can relocalize food production. And then also, if we're going to get caught in a resource spine, you know, with peak oil hitting us, you know, we're going to have to relearn basic skills that our ancestors had and that we no longer possess. You know, and once again, the internet could be a great way of sharing those types of skills. We could use the same tools that have been used to kind of, you know, dominate and control awareness. Can be used to open it and liberate it. And for me, that's led me to one of the main things I've been doing since 2012, is I started a web company. And we have a web magazine, we have a reality sandwich, realitysandwich.com, and a social network called Evolver, Evolver.net. And so the idea would be to use media and social network tools to help engineer this transformation of human consciousness, ultimately on a global level. Put out one other idea that I like to use as a metaphor for how this transformation could happen quickly, which is from Peter Russell. People know his work at all? Well, it's actually in a book they have out there, The Mysteries of Potential. But he talks about how it seems as if there's an acceleration in revolutions in human society, human consciousness, where these revolutions are happening at exponentially faster rates of linear time. You know, so you had the agricultural revolution, which took kind of thousands of years to develop. And then at a certain point, you know, we created enough surplus and led to the industrial revolution, which just took hundreds of years. You know, after that developed to its full point, became a global phenomenon, we've had the information or knowledge revolution, which has just taken tens of years. And you know, each of these revolutions is built on the last one. You know, so you couldn't have had industry without a service for agriculture, you couldn't have had the information revolution until factories could get everybody the Blackberries and the computers and so on. So looking at this scale, Peter Russell proposes that we might be on the cusp of another revolutionary shift in human society and human consciousness. And he argues that this would be from this information age, information revolution, to what he calls a wisdom revolution. And you know, on his scale, you know, if we had agriculture in thousands of years, you know, industry in hundreds of years, you know, knowledge or information in tens of years, you know, we could potentially get wisdom in like 2 to 3 years. You know, I think we're seeing the first indications, you know, that the kind of intention of human society can be repurposed from clearly material goals, physical goals, comfort, gratification goals, to an evolution of our psychic capacities, psychic potential.